Du lytter til Radio 24/7. Den originale taleradio.
Velkommen til Aflyttet med Anders Kjærulf.
Velkommen til et program, der er iført skæg og blå briller, i hvert fald indeni, hvor der i denne uge hopper en af verdens mest anerkendte teknologikritikere rundt. Han hedder Eugene Morozov, er født i Rusland, men bor i USA. Han er visiting fellow på Stanford University og hos The New America Foundation. Han har skrevet to bøger, The Net Delusion, The Dark Side of Internet Freedom og To Save Everything, Click Here, The Folly of Technological Solutionism. Og så skriver Morozov i aviser som The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, The Economist, The Guardian, The New Yorker, New Scientist og New Republic. I år, der udnævnte tidsskriftet Politico ham til den 28. mest indflydelsesrige europæer, og i slutningen af oktober i år, der var han så i Danmark for at tale på Copenhagen Business School. Jeg fik ham logget ind i Aflyttet studie til en snak om digitalisering, kunstig intelligens og tech-problemer, der ikke fandtes, før nogen fandt på en løsning. Forvirret? Fortvivl ikke. Der er rig mulighed for at blive klogere den næste time her i det her lille vindue ud i det overvågningssamfund, som vi alle sammen bor i. Jeg hedder Anders Kjærulf. Velkommen til.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
There's this concept of digitization, which is currently running all over the world, and it has kind of also kind of developed over time. If you should define digitalization, what is going on currently?
Well, digitization is not a term I personally use. I think it's a term that conceals more than reveals. But when it's used in public discourse, especially by policymakers, it usually refers to this almost inevitable structural change in our society, where more and more activities, social activities, economic activities, become mediated or facilitated by providers of various digital technologies. Those technologies might have to do with sensors, they might have to do with algorithms, they might have to do with big data, but the underlying ideological assumption behind this concept is that as we put more and more technology into domains that were previously free of it, things will become more efficient, they will become easier to use, they will become frictionless, and we will, of course, save a lot of money, which is, I think, the main reason why so many governments celebrate this ideology.
Hvad er egentlig digitalisering? Hvad er det for noget? Og hvad går det ud på, spørger jeg Eugene Morozov, der mener, at det er et udtryk, der bliver brugt af politikere og meningsdannere med det formål at føre digital teknologi ind i vores love via markedsgørelse. Jo mere teknologi, jo mere effektivt, friktionsløst og ikke mindst meget, meget billigere bliver alting, lyder det. Og det er den sidste grund, at det angiveligt bliver billigere, der gør, at politikere over hele verden vender sig mod den ideologi, som digitaliseringen egentlig er.
Mm. And you call it an ideology. It's a kind of, they are also kind of, you know, selling it like a nature force or something like that.
Well, it's clearly being presented as something inevitable. But this inevitability is the core ideological premise of this concept. It's the idea that this is happening naturally for causes that are just out there. Nobody has caused it. There are no lobbyists pushing it. There are no big consulting firms that stand to gain. There are no long-term dependencies on the digital platforms that we're creating. All of that is left out of the discussion, and we're instead focusing on this marvelous, bright, pinky future that will emerge if only we accelerate that process. In that sense, it is clearly an ideology. It's not by any means a natural process.
Digitalisering præsenteres konstant som noget helt aldeles uafvendeligt, og som noget, der er uden ulemper. Hvis bare vi gør det hurtigere, så skal det nok blive godt, siger politikerne. Og her i Danmark, her taler Digitaliseringsstyrelsen om dyb digitalisering og om digitalisering i verdensklasse. Men hvilke samfund skaber det?
Do we have a picture? Where do you think this digitalisation, if we follow the lead of this ideology, what kind of society will it create?
Well, the reason why it's so appealing to governments is because it allows to present many of the reforms and necessities that they have been undertaking in the last few years as something that is actually proactive and aggressive and is something that politicians are doing on their own terms. So if you look at governments across Europe, clearly you see that their budgets are shrinking. They are still suffering to some extent from the consequences of austerity and the financial crisis. The welfare institutions are no longer what they used to be. They're telling us we can no longer afford the kind of very humane care that we used to have, for example, in the healthcare system. And since none of those things are any more affordable, what is to replace them is this transition to a world heavily mediated by providers of digital technology, where the argument goes, we will get functional equivalents of those services, but provided by machines, by robots, will be supervised by sensors and cameras, and there is very little to lose, and we might in fact gain if we start finding ways to unlock the immense financial value of some of the data that wealth institutions have been collecting over the last few decades. So many countries are debating whether they can actually sell access to their healthcare data to private providers, whether they are pharmaceutical companies or big technology firms. Some are debating ways in which they can maybe offer some kind of benefits and concessions to various big data firms to come and analyze the entire bureaucracy in order to identify things that can be cut, things that can be optimized, things that can be rendered more efficient. But by and large, I find this rhetoric to be a very convenient cover-up for the immense budget cuts that governments have to take. And I mean, they're undertaking for various reasons. Some of it has to do with making national economies become more competitive in the international context. Some of it is driven by, desire to become leaner. Variations differ. But by and large, this rhetoric of digitization conceals what, if we really had the proper language of political economy, we might call neoliberalization or financialization of the economy, where what we used to take as welfare is now offered to us as private care provided by digital services of various kinds.
Det er en af grundene til, at det vokser så meget, digitaliseringen. Der kan spares en masse penge ved, at man lader som om, at teknologi kan det samme som mennesker. For eksempel via såkaldt digital velfærd og robotter. Staterne har ikke råd til at gøre, som vi gjorde i gamle dage. Pengene er forsvundet, blandt andet til techfirmaerne, som så til gengæld tilbyder digitale løsninger, der ligner det, der var før. Der skal spares penge, mener man. Og det er mange forskellige grunde. Og der er digitalisering perfekt til at skjule den centrale, underliggende dagsorden, som er en total brølende neoliberalisering af vores samfund, siger Morozov. Velfærd, det er i dag privatdrevet, og magten, den er ved at blive skiftet fra staten til techfirmaerne, siger Morozov. Sundhedsvæsen, transport og velfærd er på vej ud i den digitale økonomi. Det store spørgsmål er så, hvem der får noget ud af det?
It's a shift in the power in many ways, where you are actually shifting away the power over data and control of the citizens from the state and to the big companies of tech.
Sure. And again, here it's very important to emphasize that there is no need to be technophobic, that we can imagine many services in the sectors like transportation or education or healthcare very well mediated and enhanced through digital technology and observation. The key debate here is what the political economy of this change will be. Who's going to own the data? who's going to benefit from the ownership of that data financially, but also actually in real terms, and how we're going to do it, whether it's going to be to the benefit of citizens who will suddenly enjoy many more services that will be offered to them for free, or will it be to the benefit of big digital platform providers who will have a chance to actually start charging citizens for services that were previously available to them for free. And I think the very depoliticized nature of this term digitization allows us to basically present anybody opposed to it as a technophobe, as somebody who would rather not touch technology, not touch data, not touch sensors, and just kind of go back to the previous era and, you know, just to talk to humans. And there is nothing in my critique that has that technophobic element to it. I'm all for modern services, and I'm all for creating a modern, adequate welfare state. But again, it has to be done on conditions that favor the citizens, who, after all, are the main sources of value in the digital economy, because we are the ones providing the data and not the service operators, the digital platforms that have found very clever ways to expropriate our data and then build services with it, but have not contributed anything else by way of actual innovation. They are very clever in terms of innovating how to extract more and more data, but they are not making our lives longer or more meaningful by any reasonable stretch.
And you're making, when you're criticizing them, that you're being called a Luddite or a person who don't like tech.
Uh-huh. Well, unfortunately, this is, again, how the current technology debate operates, because it has no politics in it. It has no way to talk about political economy, because we are so accustomed to the idea that the only way to do something like internet search is by relying on Google, that we tend to forget that throughout centuries, we have built many rather successful institutions of collecting and organizing knowledge, museums, libraries, universities, archives. All of those have emerged on a very different system. They were not meant to optimize the sale of advertising, and they were not built in order to extract data in order to build artificial intelligence. They were built to facilitate access to knowledge on terms that will create a citizenry that is well-informed and able to participate in politics. And it's that kind of idea of a public that is eager and ready to participate in politics that we are losing as we are envisioning every single user of digital services as just a consumer who is looking for a frictionless experience. Because that's the dominant mindset. And I think that's the dominant mindset we have to challenge. And it's only by presenting, first of all, that another way and another world of digital technology is possible, with a very different ownership system, with a very different ownership structure, that we would be able to challenge this idea that anybody who is criticizing Google, Apple, or Silicon Valley in general now is a Luddite. Because many of us are not Luddites. We just don't like the ultimate political economic consequences of trusting so much power to big tech.
Hver gang man modsiger tech-industriens idéer, så bliver man kaldt teknofob eller maskinstormer. Men den diskussion handler ikke om teknologi. Den handler om at skabe et reelt fremskridt, der gavner borgerne, siger altså Eugenie Morozov. De digitale platforme har været smart til at få alle vores data og til at sælge dem, men faktisk gør de ikke vores liv længere eller mere meningsfyldt, siger Eugenie Morozov. Når vi for eksempel søger på internettet, ja, så er vi blevet bildt ind, at vi bruger noget helt banebrydende teknologi, men vi har årtusinder før haft måder at organisere og finde viden på. Det har til gengæld aldrig før været meningen, at et biblioteks søgesystemer skulle være profitmaksimerende eller bruges til at trække borgernes data ud, så man kan bygge kunstig intelligens. Men sådan er det faktisk endt i dag, siger Morozov, der er træt af at blive kaldt maskinstormer og ludit, når han udfordrer Big Techs tankegang. Men hvad er alternativet til Big Tech i dag? Findes der overhovedet et?
Well, the alternative, I think, is to, again, be very careful in tracing where value in this digital society and digital ecosystem comes from. And I think we have taken at face value the rhetoric of big tech. And the rhetoric of big tech is that all that value comes from genius innovator entrepreneurs like Steve Jobs, who are spending days and nights in their garages in order to produce the next Apple. And I think that's a very misleading picture and conception of how innovation actually happens. First of all, it completely removes the state from the picture, and the American state, and now we see in China also the Chinese state, have been fundamental to fostering the kind of broader ecosystems that make something like Silicon Valley possible. It's not just the product of entrepreneurs, it's the product of very well orchestrated government policy. But more recently, this conception and this focus on the creative genius, you know, the rebel that contributes so much to society, it clearly understates the contribution that we make as users of those firms and of those services. Clearly, much of the advance in the development of artificial intelligence over the last decade is due to the ability of these firms to harness and harvest the data that we are generating, and then use that data to train their systems to recognize objects, to recognize voice, to recognize faces, and so forth, without understanding that these companies have built a very profitable system of essentially appropriating our social life and using it as an input by means of data into production of their services. We are never going to even conceive of what a juster and more fair arrangement would be. And according to me, that just and fair arrangement would include finding a way to socialize the data layer, so using data that we all generate, a lot of it in common, as infrastructure of some kind, and then having strong public entities. They could be cities, they could be municipalities, it could be the nation state, even the European Commission, serve as intermediaries that will then set conditions of access to that infrastructure. So if I'm a local library or a local NGO, or a local entrepreneur, it should be easier for me to build services for the citizens of Denmark or for the neighbors of my particular municipality than it will be for Google or Uber or Amazon. So those firms should pay a fee in order to come in and build services on top of that data. And local developers and libraries should actually get a grant from public venture fund of some kind in order to come and build services working with that data. It's only by building this differential access on top of infrastructure that we all own in common that we would be able to articulate a different vision for the digital economy and society at large.
Vi bør starte med at udfordre Big Techs idé om, at det er dem og deres ingeniører, der skaber værdier ved at stå i deres garage og lave det næste Apple. Vi tror, at det er Steve Jobs-typer, der skaber velfærd, men det er jo slet ikke tilfældet, siger Morozov. For det, de lever af, det er os og staterne, de skaber mulighederne for dem og politikken omkring det. Det er os som borgere, der sætter gang i det hele, ikke en eller anden app. Som det ser ud nu, så hugger firmaer som Uber, Amazon, Facebook og Google data, som vi europæere afleverer til dem, ganske gratis, og de omsætter dem til virkelig lukrative forretninger, som vi intet får ud af. Min vision for, hvad der kunne gøres anderledes, siger Morozov, det er, at de lande, der leverer data og skal have noget ud af dem. Et lokalt bibliotek eller et almindeligt dansk firma bør have adgang til lokale data gratis, mens de store fra udlandet bør betale en afgift, når de bruger dem. Data skal være ejet af de, der skaber dem, siger altså Eugenie Morozov. Men er det ikke at gå ret imod globaliseringen?
I don't think it goes against globalization. It goes against the current conception of free trade as favoring big multinationals, because that's what essentially is the system that we've built. All of the trade treaties, for example, that we've been signing, our governments have been signing, they favor a very particular conception of free trade, and it's a conception of free trade that favors the rights of big multinational companies to do business everywhere they want. You can have a very different conception of globalization, where you would be promoting small firms, we would be promoting smaller players, smaller non-government players, in order to pursue their own particular versions of different services and experiment as much as they would like. Because the version that we are likely to see of the digital economy, if we don't do anything, will result in one or two dominant players, either Americans or Chinese, dominating the rest of the globe, where Europe is likely to become just a passive consumer of those services and it might even lose the dominance that it has in the most important industries of the day, like cars. You know, the risk facing Europe, if it does not find a way to somehow radically challenge the terms on which the current digital economy develops, is that it will become like Foxconn, you know, this manufacturer of Apple devices that is based in Taiwan. And, you know, they make some money, but their profit margins are relatively small. You know, they actually do all the physical work, but most of the profit goes to Apple because Apple controls the level of ideas, level of intellectual property rights, and these guys at Foxconn are just hardware manufacturers. And much of European industry, in a world dominated by artificial intelligence, risks becoming that. It will just be a bunch of hardware manufacturers with the most important artificial intelligence layers that will guide our cars, will guide our healthcare systems, being in the hands of either the Americans or the Chinese. So you might, of course, say that this is also going against globalization, but it's a globalization that is clearly favoring certain poles and is favoring others. And I think Europe should use all the might it has in order to challenge the terms on which this current wave of globalization unfolds.
Globalisering behøver ikke kun at være i den form, vi har nu, hvor vi favoriserer store dominerende firmaer fra USA og Kina, der leverer alle services, som vi så bare forventes at forbruge helt passivt. Europa er nødt til at udfordre den her model, eller så ender vi som en slags underleverandør til dem. For eksempel ligesom Foxconn, der egentlig laver alle iPhones rent fysisk, mens Apple tjener alle pengene. Og det allerstørste problem, vi har for tiden, det hedder kunstig intelligens, AI. For at lave kunstig intelligens, så skal man bruge data for at træne det op, og man skal bruge mange data. Og her sidder USA og Kina massivt på alle de data, man skal bruge til at træne og udvikle den teknologi. Europa har ikke noget Alibaba eller Facebook eller Google eller Amazon, der helt automatisk skraber data op.
If you look at, for example, for as you mentioned here, the development of artificial intelligence, that kind of depends on how much data you've got. What's the situation for Europe here? How are we doing?
Well, Europe does not have one crucial element in the current ecosystem, which the Americans and the Chinese have, which is big technology platforms that have some kind of a consumer interface that offer services like email or search or payments, which is where most of the consumer data is collected by the likes of Google or by the likes of Alibaba or Tencent in China. Without having that data, it becomes prohibitively expensive to actually build and train those systems. There are many other complications. The data that is now being collected in Europe mostly ends up flowing to the United States, right? Because most of the services that we use are American ones. This is why in the last few months, even many European politicians have started raising the possibility of actually encouraging, if not forcing, big American firms to start sharing the data that they are accumulating on European users with other European companies or with public authorities. Right? So there is clearly a realization that the terms of trade that exist between Europe and these big foreign providers are not necessarily fair and they do not favor Europe. There are, of course, many other problems that stand in the path of having a robust strategy. Some of them have to do with the way in which many over-stringent privacy policies that we have in Europe, they, while protecting individual rights, they do not necessarily go in the direction of fostering the building of this AI-driven systems, which points me not towards saying that we should abandon privacy, but which points me towards saying that we need to have actually robust privacy-by-design technologies that will have built-in incentives and that will also actually encourage people to perhaps donate or surrender some of that data or some attributes of that data, which will not compromise their privacy, but might still contribute to solving important societal problems. Traffic congestion, climate change, better use of environmental resources, and so forth. Because ultimately, if we don't build such systems of what now is being known as data philanthropy, it will be the big American and Chinese firms that will come in and do the same and suck in that data. So you either build a public system with rules, regulations, transparency of some kind, which will encourage citizens to actually think deeper about whether they would like to share data about their movement in the city with their municipality, or whether that data will just be taken away from them by default by the providers of these digital platforms, smart cities, and digital services of various kinds, which is already happening without any control, without any transparency, and which actually goes completely unnoticed, even by most citizens.
Flere europæiske politikere begyndt at tale om at kræve deres data tilbage for USA. Det simpelthen ikke fair, den måde det foregår på nu. EU har meget strenge privacy-regler i forhold til USA og Kina, og derfor så er vi nødt til at lave teknologier, der kan fungere inden for det. Men store verdensomspændende problemer som trafik, klimaændringer og den slags, der kan vi slet ikke være med uden data, hvis vi gerne vil løse dem. Som det ser ud nu, så er Europa vildt bagud på point. Men måske er de tilsyneladende vindere, USA og Kina, også ved at blive taget indenom. Det foregår via en japansk bank, den hedder SoftBank. Den har investeret massivt i firmaer som Uber og robotfirmaer og mange andre, simpelthen for at få del i data til udvikling af AI.
This Japanese company called SoftBank is not actually a bank, so you see already some ideological confusion even at that level. They call themselves a bank, but they actually are not a bank, and they're not a software company, even though they have both soft and bank in the name. So SoftBank is the owner of one of the largest telecommunication networks in Canada, in Japan, sorry. So essentially they provide and operate one of the mobile networks, which guarantees them a stable flow of cash. But in the last few years, they've been also taking very bold moves. They borrow a lot of money on international markets, which, you know, should increasingly raise some alarms, because you clearly see that the current state of tech is deeply intertwined and interlinked with the consequences of the financial crisis. So a company like SoftBank can borrow $140 billion at very low interest rates and then reinvest them into anything it wants. And the only reason why it's possible is because the interest rates following the financial crisis are so low. So SoftBank has been putting together a very large, actually the largest technology fund called Vision Fund, where the money comes not from SoftBank, even though they have invested some money of its own, but it comes from outside sources. And most of those sources, or most substantial sources, actually are the money coming from so-called sovereign wealth fund, which is a concept that might be known in Nordic countries primarily because of the Norwegian sovereign wealth fund, which invests a lot of public money into publicly traded company. In the case of SoftBank, you actually have money coming from countries like Saudi Arabia and coming from countries like United Arab Emirates, which basically is often borrowed money. It's not money coming from oil wealth, even though some of it clearly is. A lot of it is also borrowed money because these countries are quite clever. They know that, again, interest rates are very low, and they might run out of oil soon. So they go and borrow billions, and then they invest those billions into the most profitable companies, or at least most promising companies out there. Those are companies in robotics, the companies in artificial intelligence. Those are platforms, right? And why do they like platforms so much? Because platforms basically scale very well. You build software like Uber once, and then you can come and penetrate virtually all of the world's markets in it, right? Because you essentially can find taxis everywhere. SoftBank is one of the main investors through its fund and through the money coming from Saudi Arabia into all of these big promising companies. And to me, it clearly indicates that if there is no strategic change and strategic thinking about these matters in Europe, most of our promising robotics and artificial intelligence startups and companies will be bought up by this global capital in search of returns. It will be bought up by the likes of SoftBank. You know, Saudi Arabia apparently committed $45 billion to this fund. And before this recent scandal broke out, they were about to commit another $45 billion. So essentially, it's $90 billion at the disposal of this fund. And you can buy a lot of companies with it. So unless Europe manages to produce something that could be equivalent by drawing on many money that is stored in our pension funds and similar institutions, we'll end up with most of our promising industry that might guarantee some kind of a fair play when it comes to resisting or counterbalancing the Chinese or the Americans, most of the European industry will just be bought up, right? And that, I think, is a shortcoming of European policy on these matters. And so far, European politicians are not really thinking along those lines, with a few exceptions, like Germany, for example, where after a couple of very promising robotics companies have actually been bought up, politicians have suddenly realized that institutions like sovereign wealth funds might actually be needed even in a country like Germany.
SoftBank ejer teleselskaber i Japan og tjener masser af penge, men de låner også enormt mange penge, op til $140 billion, hvilket giver dem verdens største teknologiinvesteringsfond, den hedder Vision Fund. De mange penge, de kommer fra Saudi-Arabien og de arabiske emirater. Saudi og emiraterne låner i øvrigt mange af de penge, som de hælder ind i Vision Fund, men det betyder mindre, så længe renten er lav. Meget tyder på, mener Mosoff, at alle Europas robot- og kunstig intelligensfirmaer er ved at blive opkøbt af SoftBank, hvilket betyder, at Europa står endnu dårligere i fremtiden. Modgiften mod det kunne være, at Europa begyndte at bruge de mange penge, der ligger i vores pensionskasser, til at købe de her livsvigtige firmaer op selv. Men det skal gå hurtigt, ellers er det for sent. Imens så har hele verden, og ikke mindst Danmark, travlt med at hyperdigitalisere og bygge smarte byer og proppe internet ind i alting. Tiden er smart, hedder det, men det udtryk, det har Eugenie Morozov sin egen oversættelse af, Surveillance Marketed as Revolutionary Technology, overvågning markedsført som revolutionær teknologi.
You've coined, I have to mention this, you've coined, there's one of the words who keeps going around in the current modern world is the word smart, which yes. You have, you've made your own interpretation of this. Mm-hmm. So you're saying it's called surveillance marketed as revolutionary technology.
Mm-hmm.
Could you elaborate a bit on that?
Well, of course. In popular discourse, whenever a term smart is used, what is implied by it is some kind of frictionless adaptation to your needs and desires, right? And very often, those needs and desires are assumed to be those of this powerful sovereign consumer who, according to our conception of the economy, is really the king of the world. So it's a person whose demands are immediately satisfied by observing his or her anxieties and desires and wishes. And once the system knows enough about those desires, an advertising appears or a product gets delivered by Amazon, perhaps even completely unannounced. It's not for nothing that Amazon a few years ago has patented this technology called anticipatory shipping, where products will be delivered to you before you even order them, just by observing and surveying essentially what it is that you do. So the idea of smartness as just being an extension of surveillance to me is quite evident, because ultimately, without surveying everything we do and drawing some kind of inferences about what our aspirations are, much of this digital economy, fueled by online shopping and advertising, simply wouldn't exist. Again, this is not to say that we cannot think of systems that will use some kind of a feedback mechanism in order to make us learn better. Like, I can easily imagine that learning a foreign language might actually be greatly facilitated by constantly observing what we learn and what we don't learn, and then actually improving our memorization skills. The problem is that that whole discourse of facilitation and personalization has been completely captured by this data obsessive industry whose only interest is in having us buy more products. And I think recapturing that discourse from it and finding ways in which you can balance this idea of evading the rather standardized institutions that might be too bureaucratic, that might be too formalized. Right? I mean, it's true that our society is not necessarily fully configured to account for people who are too creative or want to be autonomous. So much of the early critique of this idea of standardization that, you know, we saw it in many education systems in 1960s, as people like Ivan Illich, for example, much of that critique was true. So not everything in this idea of environments that should be adapting to us is flawed. The problem is that, you know, this means of adaptation, so to say, right, have been completely captured by the technology industry and through them also by advertising and shopping industry. So the task that I think remains for us who would like to perhaps keep some of those nicer elements of personalization, but without reducing it just to consumption only into this idea of sovereign consumer, is to be able to think of ways in which digital technology can also inform a very different political and social project, where perhaps some of the standardization would be gone, but it would be gone precisely to enable critical thinking, participation in politics, more provocation, perhaps more conflict and friction, and not frictionlessness, which is precisely what this new smart system would like us to believe in.
Smart sælges som en friktionsfri, nem indfrielse af vores begær. Men smart er bare en udvidelse af den overvågning, vi allerede er inde i. Det er ikke for sjov, at Amazon har taget patent på såkaldt forventede bestillinger. At man simpelthen har overvåget og analyseret os så godt, at ting, vi ikke engang har bestilt, allerede er pakket og afsendt, før vi selv har fået tanken, siger Eugenie Morozov. Den måde, teknologi udvikles på for tiden, har én fælles dagsorden, at reducere os til forbrugere, der skal presses til sidste krone af stadig mere intelligente maskiner. Men det behøver ikke være sådan, siger Morozov. Vi burde udvikle teknologi, der udfordrede os, opfordrede til kritisk tænkning og til at skabe bedre samfund og mere givende måder at være mennesker på. Det kan sagtens lade sig gøre, hævder han. Vi skal bare have vendt båden den anden vej. Og så skal vi holde op med at bilde os ind, at det er godt for os, at alting er automatisk og gnidningsløst. Tværtimod skal vi have mere friktion og mere modstand ind i vores liv, siger Morozov.
If you take the concept of friction, why is that important?
Well, because ultimately we do not live by market alone, right? In market relations, you might think that frictionless is good because you don't want to have transaction costs, you don't want to spend too much time haggling with people buying or selling services, but we also live by democratic standards and commitments, right? And the whole idea of democracy is not driven by the idea of consensus, it's driven also by the idea of agonism, right? We are supposed to engage in debate, we are supposed to test each other's positions, we are supposed to perhaps compare whether my conception of the world is adequate to your conception of the world. And to me, this is all by almost logical extension implies friction. And unfortunately, this political dimension to our everyday life and to our life in general is by and large ignored by digital firms because their business models leave no room and no space for democratic participation in their systems because they're not interested in it. And for them, it's just an extra expense that they can easily eliminate. So from that perspective, I think giving a more positive spin to the idea of friction, to the idea of agonism, and try to imagine it as something that might actually be conducive to a more robust democratic life should be one of our main priorities in analyzing what the smart systems eliminate and what it is that they contribute to our public life.
Vi må aldrig glemme, at hjørnestenen i demokratiet er uenighed og diskussion. At vi tester vores holdninger af på hinanden. Firmaerne bag smarte systemer, de er ikke interesserede i at gøre dem demokratiske. Det er besværligt og dyrt og giver ikke umiddelbar værdi, men det er det, vi skal kæmpe for at få mere af. Mere demokrati i teknologi. Men hvad så med de smarte byer? Smart cities. Det koncept, som det meste af Europa omfavner i dag. Ja, siger Morozov. Smart by, det er i virkeligheden en fuld privatiseret by med bedre marketing.
One of the, let's say, one of the meta smart systems that is going around all over the world is the idea of the smart city.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see that? That is kind of where you you embed the idea of smart technology into one of the most condensed forms of societies. We have the cities.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see this evolving currently?
Well, one vulgar way to describe the smart city would be to say that it's just a fully privatized city with better marketing, right? So in that sense, what is currently being sold under this label is privately run and operated energy system, traffic management system, tourist management system, garbage management systems, which all sold as something that works much better, much more efficiently, much cheaper. And all of that is made possible by analyzing millions of data flows and using those data flows precisely in order to optimize the provision of the service. So what is meant by smart here differs from case to case, but it's a combination of forces. Some of it is the idea that all the systems will become more environmentally sustainable because they'll be able to cut out the slack, which might be currently damaging the environment, for example. Some of it has to do with the costs, that it will actually be cheaper and we will be able to redeploy money and that would fly somewhere else. But I think the overarching common denominator here is that all the systems will be provided by big technology firms. So by extension and almost by natural logic, they will be privatized. And through this privatization and the digitization through the back door, we'll be achieving the kind of success that we couldn't achieve through previous interventions, like urban planning that was more modernist in its outlook, like some kind of technocratic management of resources. You kind of take the technocrat out of the equation, you know, and this figure of the technocrat, this figure of the urban planner, was the main target of many, you know, neoliberal thinkers about the city. And for them, that figure of the technocrat was something that stood in the way of capital accumulation, because cities in the current global economy are not just places where people and workers live. They are also mainly actually instruments and sources of investment. Real estate has become a major chunk of the global economy, and that chunk is actually growing and growing. So there is this idea that, you know, you need to get out of the way because you really want to create parts of the city, at least, where you can charge premium rents because everything is working flawlessly. Maybe it's a gated community. Maybe you can actually exclude people who might pose a danger of certain kind. Maybe you will actually be able to offer even more superior services when it comes to garbage collection, for example, or noise reduction and so forth. So this idea that you need to create spaces in the city that will be run in a different, more superior logic without any technocratic intervention, it appeals to a lot of people. It appeals not just to tech companies, it appeals to a lot of real estate developers. So in many cases, like the example of Google in Canada, where they are launching particular, very specific projects in cities like Toronto, where an entire quarter of the city now is being reshaped by Google, they essentially partnerships between real estate developers who want these quarters where they can charge much higher rents, and technology firms who would like to get a little bit of that action in the real estate sector, but who also want to continue extracting all the data that they can find from domains that are not directly related to the use of their services. So urban expansion for Google makes perfect sense because ultimately the logic that propels them is what I call the logic of data extractivism. They really want to extract as much data from as many domains as possible. And clearly the city is one of the most important domains you can imagine that currently is not already under Google's dominance. So that explains why they have to start thinking in the urban plane, even if Google never actually uses the term smart city in its marketing. They have understood that already there is some kind of resistance to that concept, and they just stopped using it. And this, again, should make us aware that the concepts come and go, but the underlying processes are always there, and they have to be very careful to understand what's the political economy behind them.
Alle de systemer, der er i smarte byer, er private. De er ikke ejet af kommunen eller borgerne. Datastrømmen, den bruges til at optimere ydelserne, og de, der leverer systemerne, det er de store tech-firmaer. Byplanlæggeren er ude af spillet. Han står i vejen for, at firmaer kan tjene penge. Smarte byer er rigtig godt for developers, store pengetanke, der køber op på ejendomsmarkedet. Smarte byer giver dem muligheden for at tage høje huslejer og til at smide folk ud, der ikke passer ind. Det elsker ejendomsspekulanter og firmaer som Google, der allerede er i gang med at lave deres helt egen smarte by i Vancouver i Canada, og deres muligheder for at rykke alle data ud af beboerne, der simpelthen flytter ind i maskinen selv, de er gigantiske. På mange måder er smarte byer et eksempel på endnu et begreb, som Eugenie Morozov har skabt, nemlig solutionismen, løsningsmani, trangen til at opfinde løsninger, især tekniske, som man kan sælge på problemer, der ikke fandtes før løsningen var der.
You have this term you also coined that it's called solutionism, where you have technology, where you kind of you kind of invent solution where there some problems will arise. Mm-hmm. Did I understand that correctly? Is that how to see it?
Well, one of my intents in coining this term, actually I didn't coin, I popularized it. It was a term that was already coined, but one of my intentions in popularizing it was to point out that how we define problems is a deeply political process, because the way in which two conflicting parties, labor and capital, for example, would define a problem differs quite a lot, and it depends on what the underlying objectives are. You know, capital might define a problem in one way, but workers would define it differently. Urban planners would define the problem one way, and residents would define the problem differently. Our entire political system was built on the assumption that we need to create forums of discussion, some kind of democratic mediating institutions, where these different conceptions of the problem can actually be discussed, and where a more coherent definition of it can actually be articulated. What has happened in the last decade or so was the gradual disappearance of such fora. And what has happened instead is that this dominant idea that, you know, we would like to have more technology because technology means progress, and how could anybody be against progress? Like, that idea has led to a situation where technology companies have actually become the dominant definers of what a problem is constituted by and what the solution to it should be. And of course, in most cases, it was obvious that the solutions they were proposing were the natural extensions of the underlying business models. So for Google, a way to solve a problem like lack of parking spaces in a city clearly had to do with not having enough data about where those free spaces might be, right? So what I tried to show in introducing that concept was that as long as we surrendered the public debate to the so-called innovators, those innovators have a natural bias towards defining the solutions to the problems in a way that favors their business models, and that's not a healthy development, and that we should actually understand it for what it is, and perhaps challenge the idea that, first of all problems have these clean, neat solutions that can be summarized in the form of an app that you can install on your phone and work on climate change or work on climate reduction or work on, you know, solving something in your city. But you also have to challenge a little bit more broadly this idea that all problems are neat and can be defined, and it doesn't really matter who defines it as long as a clean and nice solution awaits us on the horizon. Because I think in that process, powerful interests tend to reinsert and amplify themselves. And if we don't create forums where weak people, people without political power, can also articulate what they think constitutes a problem, will actually end up eliminating them entirely from the political landscape.
Så længe vi overgiver os til startup-folket og innovatørerne, så ender vi med, at alle problemer har en fin, ren løsning i en app. Men det er problemer, der er defineret for at sælge os mere teknologi. Det bliver tech-industrien, der definerer spørgsmålene og leverer svarene samtidig, og dermed så lukker de for mulighederne for at se anderledes på samfundet, siger Morozov og fortsætter. Vi er nødt til at have forummer, hvor svage, magtesløse mennesker også kan formulere, hvad de mener er problemer, og nå politikerne. Men er der nogen, der lytter til ham, Morozov, overhovedet, eller drukner han i teknologier, singularitet, disruption og alt det andet?
How do you feel about it in general? Is everyone listening to you? Do you see changes going on because of what you you kind of your critique?
Well, I think it's getting a little bit better in the last few years. Clearly, the critique of big technology or big tech, which finally has become a term, it wasn't a term 5 years ago. You know, I've been encouraging people to stop using big data as if it was just a concept. It was also for me a nice description of this industry, like big pharma, you know, big energy. So there are a lot of people worried about big tech. What we worry about, however, is something that we need to be a little bit clear of, right? So, I mean, I don't see technology companies as some kind of irrational predators, like as an aberration in contemporary capitalism. For me, they are rather rational players who have been given quite a lot of space by the governments. If we really want to change the way in which this current digital economy operates, it's to our governments that we should be assigning the blame, not to big tech. We have to understand the way in which big tech frames the debate, in which they define the issues, they define the problems, all of that is kind of ideological work that we need to do. But I think we have to be careful not to misappropriate, misassign or assign it incorrectly the blame, right? Because if we do that, we end up going after the wrong target. The right target for me are the governments. We have to understand why the governments do that. We have to understand why they get in bed with all sorts of shady and nefarious institutions. Like here in Denmark, I've discovered the Singularity University is one of the big players in the country. And to me, you know, I was thinking about it this morning, how on earth did the country went from solidarity to singularity in one generation?
Hvis vi virkelig gerne vil ændre noget, så er det vores regeringer, vi skal tage fat i. Tech-firmaer er faktisk rationelle og går efter deres egen agendaer, og det er vores regeringer, der skal se at få sat grænser for dem, ikke bare invitere dem indenfor. Som jeg kan forstå, I gør her i Danmark med Singularity University, siger Eugenie Morozov, der kalder Singularity U for en skummel organisation, mens han undrer sig over, hvordan vi som land kan gå fra solidaritet til singularitet på en enkelt generation.
Right, and that was not something that's obvious, but again, primarily, I don't want to blame the founders of the Singularity University for that. They have an agenda, they're very rational, but why on earth are politicians buying into that? And it's to them that I think most of our anger and critique has to be addressed. And I'm quite actually confident that in the last few years, as it becomes obvious that internet is not about the internet at all. It's about how economy operates, how trade operates, how jobs will be provided, that people are beginning to wake up and start asking the right questions. Because ultimately, if we continue keeping it as some kind of, oh, it's all about advertising, or it's all about privacy, and never ask questions about automation, or about trade, or about justice, or about distribution of data, then of course it will remain a rather marginal issue. So building these broad bridges to the rest of the economy, I think, is a prerequisite to mobilizing more people to join this fight.
Thank you very much, Eugene Morozov.
Thank you so much for having me.
Det var altså teknologikritiker og forfatter Eugenie Morozov, der fortalt om muligheder og udfordringer i det digitale liv, som vi skubbes ind i fra alle sider. Og med det, så er Aflyttet forbi for i dag. Jeg hedder Anders Kjærulf, og jeg og Aflyttet er tilbage igen i næste uge med mere nyt fra det overvågningssamfund, som vi alle sammen bader i. Nøgne under en stråle af gyldne løfter foran et hav af ord, der flakser foran os på vores VR-skærme, og vi forsøger at lukke øjnene og bare drømme om sandheden i en sjæl og et legeme. Det bliver ikke lige nu, men måske om lidt.
Q for Qvortrup.
Vores program beskæftiger sig med det, som alle journalister elsker at tale om, nemlig journalister.
Og A for Andersen.
Vi er jo dybest set medieverdens svar på tysk pyrometal med mange store sådan ildeffekter.
Tilsammen går de i flæsket på den danske presse.
Vi bider dem så godt, vi nu kan lidt i haserne.
Vi er to mennesker, der begge to brænder for medier og for journalistik.
Vi er begge i et vist omfang uden for det gode selskab.
Q og A. Radio 24/7's nærgående mediemagasin.
Mediebranchen er en af de mest magtfulde.
Hver mandag kl. 13.
Der er alt muligt grund til at lave et program, der kritisk går den branche efter i sømmene.
Her på Radio 24/7.
Ja, det er jo grundlæggende set det.
Den originale taleradio.
Du lytter til Radio 24/7.